He opened the door, turned back to me. And one more thing. No one finds out about this, you hear me? No one. I don't want anybody's sympathy. Then he disappeared into the dim lobby. He chain-smoked the rest of that day in front of the TV. I didn't know what or whom he was defying. Me? Dr. Amoni? Or maybe the God he had never believed in? For a while, even cancer couldn't keep Bob off from the flea market. We made our garage sale treks on Saturdays, Baba the driver and me the navigator, and set up our display on Sundays. Brass lamps, baseball gloves, ski jackets with broken zippers. Baba greeted acquaintances from the old country, and I haggled with buyers over a dollar or two, like any of it mattered. Like the day I would become an orphan wasn't inching closer with each closing of shop. Sometimes General Tahiri and his wife strolled by. The general, ever the diplomat, greeted me with a smile and his two-handed shake. But there was a new reticence to Khanum Tahiri's demeanor, a reticence broken only by her secret droopy smiles and the furtive, apologetic looks she cast my way when the general's attention was engaged elsewhere. I remember that period as a time of many firsts. The first time I heard Baba moan in the bathroom. The first time I found blood on his pillow. In over 3 years running the gas station, Baba had never called in sick. Another first. By Halloween of that year, Baba was getting so tired by mid-Saturday afternoon that he'd wait behind the wheel while I got out and bargained for junk. By Thanksgiving, he wore out before noon. When sleighs appeared on front lawns and fake snow on Douglas firs, Baba stayed home, and I drove the VW bus alone up and down the peninsula. Sometimes at the flea market, Afghan acquaintances made remarks about Baba's weight loss. At first, they were complimentary. They even asked a secret to his diet. But the queries and compliments stopped when the weight loss didn't. When the pounds kept shedding and shedding, when his cheeks hollowed and his temples melted and his eyes receded in their sockets. Then, one cool Sunday shortly after New Year's Day, Baba was selling a lampshade to a stocky Filipino man while I rummaged in the VW for a blanket to cover his legs with. "Hey man, this guy needs help," the Filipino said with alarm. I turned around and found Baba on the ground. His arms and legs were jerking. "Kumak!" I cried. "Somebody help!" I ran to Baba. He was frothing at the mouth, the foamy spittle soaking his beard. His upturned eyes showed nothing but white. People were rushing to us. I heard someone say, "Seizure." Someone else yelling, "Call 911!" I heard running footsteps. The sky darkened as a crowd gathered around us. Baba's spittle turned red. He was biting his tongue. I kneeled beside him and grabbed his arms and said, "I'm here, Baba. I'm here. You'll be all right. I'm here." As if I could soothe the convulsions out of him. Talk them into leaving my Baba alone. I felt the wetness on my knees and saw Baba's bladder had let go. "Shh, Baba John, I'm here. Your son is right here." The doctor, white-bearded and perfectly bald, pulled me out of the room. "I want to go over your father's CAT scans with you," he said. He put the films up on a viewing box in the hallway and pointed with the eraser end of his pencil to the pictures of Baba's cancer, like a cop showing mugshots of the killer to the victim's family. Baba's brain on those pictures looked like cross-sections of a big walnut, riddled with tennis ball-shaped gray things. "As you can see, the cancer is metastasized," he said. "He'll have to take steroids to reduce the swelling in his brain and anti-seizure medications. And I'd recommend palliative radiation. Do you know what that means?" I said I did. I'd become conversant in cancer talk. "All right then," he said. He checked his beeper. "I have to go, but you can have me paged if you have any questions." "Thank you," I said. I spent the night sitting on a chair next to Baba's bed. The next morning, the waiting room down the hall was jammed with Afghans. The butcher from Newark, an engineer who had worked with Baba on his orphanage. They filed in and paid Baba their respects in hushed tones, wished him a swift recovery. Baba was awake then, groggy and tired, but awake. Mid-morning, General Tahiri and his wife came. Suraya followed. We glanced at each other and looked away at the same time. "How are you, my friend?" General Tahiri said, taking Baba's hand. Baba motioned to the IV hanging from his arm and smiled thinly. The general smiled back. "You shouldn't have burdened yourselves, all of you," Baba croaked. "It's no burden," Khanum Tahiri said. "No burden at all," the general said. "More importantly, do you need anything? Anything at all? Ask me like you'd ask a brother." I remembered something Baba had said about Pashtuns once. "We may be hard-headed, and I know we're far too proud, but in the hour of need, believe me that there's no one you'd rather have at your side than a Pashtun." Baba shook his head on the pillow. "Your coming here has brightened my eyes." The general smiled and squeezed Baba's hand. "How are you, Amirjan? Do you need anything?" The way he was looking at me, the kindness in his eyes. "Nay, thank you, General Sahib. A lump shot up in my throat, and my eyes teared over. I bolted out of the room. I wept in the hallway, by the viewing box where the night before I had seen the killer's face. Baba's door opened and Suraya walked out of his room. She stood near me. She was wearing a gray sweatshirt and jeans, and her hair was down. I wanted to find comfort in her arms. "I'm so sorry, Amir," she said. "We all knew something was wrong, but we had no idea it was this." I blotted my eyes with my sleeve. He didn't want anyone to know. "Do you need anything?" "No," I said. I tried to smile. She put her hand on mine, our first touch. I took it and brought it to my face, my eyes. I let it go. "You'd better go back inside, or your father will come after me." She smiled and nodded. "I should." She turned to go. "Suraya?" "Yes?" "I'm happy you came. It means the world to me." They discharged Baba 2 days later. They brought in a specialist called a radiation oncologist to talk Baba into getting radiation treatment. Baba refused. They tried to talk me into talking him into it. But I'd seen the look on Baba's face. I thanked them, signed their forms, and took Baba home in my Ford Torino. That night, Baba was lying on the couch, a wool blanket covering him. I brought him hot tea and roasted almonds. Wrapped my arms around his back and pulled him up much too easily. His shoulder blade felt like a bird's wing under my fingers. I pulled the blanket back up to his chest, where ribs stretched his thin, sallow skin. "Can I do anything else for you, Baba?" "Nay, bachim, thank you." I sat beside him. "Then I wonder if you'll do something for me, if you're not too exhausted." "What?" he said. "I want you to go Khastagari. I want you to ask General Tahiri for his daughter's hand." Baba's dry lips stretched into a smile. A spot of green on a wilted leaf. "Are you sure?" "More sure than I've ever been about anything." "You've thought it over?" "Bale, Baba." "Then give me the phone and my little notebook." I blinked. "Now? Then when?" he said. I smiled. "Okay." I gave him the phone and the little black notebook where Baba had scribbled his Afghan friend's numbers. He looked up the Tahiri's, dialed. He brought the receiver to his ear. My heart was doing pirouettes in my chest. "Jamila John, salam alaikum," he said. He introduced himself and paused. Much better, thank you. It was so gracious of you to come. He listened for a while and nodded. I'll remember that, thank you. Is General Sahib home? Pause. Thank you. His eyes flicked to me. I wanted to laugh for some reason, or scream. I brought the ball of my hand to my mouth and bit on it. Baba laughed softly through his nose. General Sahib, Assalamu alaikum. Yes, yes, much better. Vale, you're so kind. General Sahib, I'm calling to ask if I may pay you and Khanum Tahiri a visit tomorrow morning. It's an honorable matter. Yes. 11 o'clock is just fine. Until then, hold office. He hung up. We looked at each other. I burst into giggles and Baba joined in. Baba wet his hair and combed it back. I helped him into a clean white shirt and knotted his tie for him, noting the 2 inches of empty space between the collar button and Baba's neck. I thought of all the empty spaces Baba would leave behind when he was gone, and I made myself think of something else. He wasn't gone, not yet. And this was a day for good thoughts. The jacket of his brown suit, the one he'd worn to my graduation, hung over him. Too much of Baba had melted away to fill it anymore. I had to roll up the sleeves. I stooped and tied his shoelaces for him. The Tahiris lived in a flat, one-story house in one of the residential areas in Fremont, known for housing a large number of Afghans. It had bay windows, a pitched roof, and an enclosed front porch on which I saw potted geraniums. The general's gray van was parked in the driveway. I helped Baba out of the Ford and slipped back behind the wheel. He leaned in the passenger window. Be home. I'll call you in an hour. Okay, Baba, I said. Good luck. He smiled. I drove away. In the rearview mirror, Baba was hobbling up the Tahiri's driveway for one last fatherly duty. I paced the living room of our apartment waiting for Baba's call. 15 paces long, 10.5 paces wide. What if the general said no? What if he hated me? I kept going to the kitchen, checking the oven clock. The phone rang just before noon. It was Baba. Well? The general accepted, he said. I let out a burst of air, sat down. My hands were shaking. He did? Yes, but Soraya John is upstairs in her room. She wants to talk to you first. Okay. Baba said something to someone, and there was a double click as he hung up. Amir? Soraya's voice. Salam. My father said yes. I know, I said. I switched hands. I was smiling. I'm so happy I don't know what to say. I'm happy too, Amir. I can't believe this is happening. I laughed. I know. Listen, she said. I want to tell you something. Something you have to know before... I don't care what it is, I said. You need to know. And I don't want us to start with secrets. And I'd rather you hear it from me. If it'll make you feel better, tell me. But it won't change anything, I said. There was a long pause at the other end. When we lived in Virginia, I ran away with an Afghan man. I was 18 at the time. Rebellious, stupid, and he was into drugs. We lived together for almost a month. All the Afghans in Virginia were talking about it. Padar eventually found us. He showed up at the door and made me come home. I was hysterical, yelling, screaming, saying I hated him. Anyway, I came home and she was crying. Excuse me. I heard her put the phone down and blow her nose. Sorry, she came back on, sounding hoarse. When I came home, I saw my mother had had a stroke and the right side of her face was paralyzed, and I felt so guilty. She didn't deserve that. Padar moved us to California shortly after. A silence followed. "How are you and your father now?" I said. "Well, we've always had our differences. We still do, but I'm grateful he came for me that day. I really believe he saved me." She paused. "So, does what I told you bother you?" "A little," I said. I owed her the truth on this one. I couldn't lie to her and say that my pride, my iftikhar, wasn't stung at all that she had been with a man, whereas I had never taken a woman to bed. It did bother me a bit, but I had pondered this quite a lot in the weeks before I had asked Baba to go Khastagori, and in the end, the question that always came back to me was this: how could I, of all people, chastise someone for their past? "Does it bother you enough to change your mind?" "No, Soraya, not even close," I said. "Nothing you said changes anything. I want us to marry." She broke into fresh tears. I envied her. Her secret was out, spoken and dealt with. I opened my mouth and almost told her how I had betrayed Hassan, lied and driven him out, and destroyed a 40-year relationship between Baba and Ali. But I didn't. I suspected there were many ways in which Soraya Tahiri was a better person than me. Courage was just one of them. When we arrived at the Tahiri's home the next evening for lafs, the ceremony of giving word, I had to park the Ford across the street. The driveway was already jammed with cars. I wore a navy blue suit I had bought the previous day, after I had brought Baba home from Khastagori. I checked my tie in the rearview mirror. "You look khushtip," Baba said. "Handsome." "Thank you, Baba. Are you all right? Do you feel up to this?" "Up to this? It's the happiest day of my life, Amir," he said, smiling tiredly. I could hear chatter from the other side of the door, laughter, and Afghan music playing softly. It sounded like a classical ghazal by Ustad Sarahang. I rang the bell. A face peeked through the curtains of the foyer window and disappeared. "They're here," I heard a woman's voice say. The chatter stopped. Someone turned off the music. Khanum Tahiri opened the door. "Salaamu Alaikum," she said, beaming. She had permed her hair, I saw, and wore an elegant ankle-length black dress. When I stepped into the foyer, her eyes moistened. "You're barely in the house, and I'm crying already, Amir John," she said. I planted a kiss on her hand, just as Baba had instructed me to do the night before. She led us through a brightly lit hallway to the living room. On the wood-paneled walls, I saw pictures of the people who would become my new family. A young bouffant-haired Khanum Tahiri and the general, Niagara Falls in the background. Khanum Tahiri in a seamless dress, the general in a narrow lapel jacket and thin tie, his hair full and black. Soraya, about to board a wooden roller coaster, waving and smiling, the sun glinting off the silver wires in her teeth. A photo of the general, dashing in full military outfit, shaking hands with King Hussein of Jordan. A portrait of Zahir Shah. The living room was packed with about 24 guests seated on chairs placed along the walls. When Baba entered, everybody stood up. We went around the room, Baba leading slowly, me behind him, shaking hands and greeting the guests. The general, still in his gray suit, and Baba embraced, gently tapping each other on the back. They said their salams in respectful, hushed tones. The general held me at arm's length and smiled knowingly, as if saying, "Now this is the right way, the Afghan way, to do it, Bachim." We kissed 3 times on the cheek. We sat in the crowded room, Baba and I next to each other, across from the general and his wife. Baba's breathing had grown a little ragged, and he kept wiping sweat off his forehead and scalp with his handkerchief. He saw me looking at him and managed a strained grin. "I'm all right," he mouthed. In keeping with tradition, Soraya was not present. A few moments of small talk and idle chatter followed until the general cleared his throat. The room became quiet, and everyone looked down at their hands in respect. The general nodded toward Baba. Baba cleared his own throat. When he began, he couldn't speak in complete sentences without stopping to breathe. "General Sahib, Khanam Jamila John, it's with great humility that my son and I have come to your home today. You are honorable people from distinguished and reputable families and proud lineage. I come with nothing but the utmost ihtiram and the highest regards for you, your family names, and the memory of your ancestors." He stopped, caught his breath, and wiped his brow. "Amir John is my only son, my only child, and he has been a good son to me. I hope he proves worthy of your kindness. I ask that you honor Amir John and me and accept my son into your family." The general nodded politely. "We are honored to welcome the son of a man such as yourself into our family," he said. "Your reputation precedes you. I was your humble admirer in Kabul and remain so today. We are honored that your family and ours will be joined. Amir John, as for you, I welcome you to my home as a son, as the husband of my daughter who is the noor of my eye. Your pain will be our pain, your joy our joy. I hope that you will come to see your Khala Jamila and me as a second set of parents, and I pray for your and our lovely Soraya John's happiness. You both have our blessings." Everyone applauded, and with that signal, heads turned toward the hallway, the moment I had waited for. Soraya appeared at the end, dressed in a stunning wine-colored traditional Afghan dress with long sleeves and gold trimmings. Baba's hand took mine and tightened. Khanam Tahiri burst into fresh tears. Slowly, Soraya came to us, tailed by a procession of young female relatives. She kissed my father's hands and sat beside me at last, her eyes downcast. The applause swelled. According to tradition, Soraya's family would have thrown the engagement party, the Shirini Khuri, or eating of the sweet ceremony. Then an engagement period would have followed, which would have lasted a few months. Then the wedding, which would be paid for by Baba. We all agreed that Soraya and I would forego the Shirini Khuri. Everyone knew the reason, so no one had to actually say it, that Baba didn't have months to live. Soraya and I never went out alone together while preparations for the wedding proceeded. Since we hadn't married yet, hadn't even had a Shirini Khuri, it was considered improper. So I had to make do with going over to the Tahiris with Baba for dinner, sit across from Soraya at the dinner table, imagine what it would be like to feel her head on my chest, smell her hair, kiss her, make love to her. Baba spent $35,000, nearly the balance of his life savings, on the arusi, the wedding ceremony. He rented a large Afghan banquet hall in Fremont. The man who owned it knew him from Kabul and gave him a substantial discount. Baba paid for the chelaz, our matching wedding bands, and for the diamond ring I picked out. He bought my tuxedo and my traditional green suit for the nikah, the swearing ceremony. For all the frenzied preparations that went into the wedding night, most of it blessedly by Khanam Tahiri and her friends, I remember only a handful of moments from it. I remember our nikah. We were seated around the table, Soraya and I dressed in green, the color of Islam, but also the color of spring and new beginnings. I wore a suit, Soraya, the only woman at the table, a veiled long-sleeved dress. Baba, General Tahiri, in a tuxedo this time, and several of Soraya's uncles were also present at the table. Soraya and I looked down, solemnly respectful, casting only sideway glances at each other. The mullah questioned the witnesses and read from the Quran. We said our oaths, signed the certificates. One of Surayya's uncles from Virginia, Sharif John, Khanam Tahiri's brother, stood up and cleared his throat. Surayya had told me that he had lived in the U.S. for more than 20 years. He worked for the INS and had an American wife, Susie. He was also a poet. A small man with a bird-like face and fluffy hair, he read a lengthy poem dedicated to Surayya, jotted down on hotel stationery paper. "Wah, wah, Sharif John," everyone exclaimed when he was finished. I remember walking toward the stage, now in my tuxedo, Surayya veiled pari in white, our hands locked. Baba hobbled next to me, the general and his wife beside their daughter. A procession of uncles, aunts, and cousins followed as we made our way through the hall, parting a sea of applauding guests and blinking at flashing cameras. One of Surayya's cousins, Sharif John's son, held the Quran over our heads as we inched along. The wedding song, Ahista Buro, blared from the speakers, the same song the Russian soldier at the Mahipat checkpoint had sung the night Baba and I left Kabul. Make mourning into a key and throw it into the well. Go slowly, my lovely moon, go slowly. Let the morning sun forget to rise in the east. Go slowly, my lovely moon, go slowly. I remember sitting on the sofa, set on the stage like a throne, Surayya's hand in mine, as 300 or so faces looked on. We did Aina Mashaf, where they gave us a mirror and threw a veil over our heads, so we'd be alone to gaze at each other's reflection. Looking at Surayya's smiling face in that mirror, in the momentary privacy of the veil, I whispered to her for the first time that I loved her. A blush, red like henna, bloomed on her cheeks. I picture colorful platters of chupan kebab, sholi gushti, and wild orange rice. I see Baba between us on the sofa, smiling. I remember sweat-drenched men dancing the traditional atan in a circle, bouncing, spinning faster and faster with the feverish tempo of the tabla, until all but a few dropped out of the ring with exhaustion. I remember wishing Rahim Khan were there. And I remember wondering if Hassan too had married, and if so, whose face had he seen in the mirror under the veil? Whose henna-painted hands had he held? Around 2 a.m., the party moved from the banquet hall to Baba's apartment. Tea flowed once more and music played until the neighbors called the cops. Later that night, the sun less than an hour from rising and the guests finally gone, Surayya and I lay together for the first time. All my life, I'd been around men. That night, I discovered the tenderness of a woman. It was Surayya who suggested that she move in with Baba and me. I thought you might want us to have our own place, I said. With Kakajan as sick as he is, she replied. Her eyes told me that was no way to start a marriage. I kissed her. Thank you. Surayya dedicated herself to taking care of my father. She made his toast and tea in the morning and helped him in and out of bed. She gave him his pain pills, washed his clothes, and read him the international section of the newspaper every afternoon. She cooked his favorite dish, potato shorwa, though he could scarcely eat more than a few spoonfuls, and took him out every day for a brief walk around the block. And when he became bedridden, she turned him on his side every hour so he wouldn't get a bedsore. One day I came home from the pharmacy with Baba's morphine pills. Just as I shut the door, I caught a glimpse of Surayya quickly sliding something under Baba's blanket. Hey, I saw that. What were you two doing? I said. Nothing, Surayya said, smiling. Liar. I lifted Baba's blanket. What's this? I said, though as soon as I picked up the leather-bound notebook, I knew. I traced my fingers along the gold-stitched borders. I remembered the fireworks the night Rahim Khan had given it to me, the night of my 13th birthday, flares sizzling and exploding into bouquets of red, green, and yellow. "I can't believe you can write like this," Soraya said. Baba dragged his head off the pillow. "I put her up to it. I hope you don't mind." I gave the notebook back to Soraya and left the room. Baba hated it when I cried. A month after the wedding, the Tahiris, Sharif John, his wife Susie, and several of Soraya's aunts came over to our apartment for dinner. Soraya made sabzi chalao, white rice with spinach and lamb. After dinner, we all had green tea and played cards in groups of four. Soraya and I played with Sharif John and Susie on the coffee table, next to the couch where Baba lay under a wool blanket. He watched me joking with Sharif John, watched Soraya and me lacing our fingers together, and watched me push back a loose curl of her hair. I could see his internal smile, as wide as the skies of Kabul on nights when the poplars shivered and the sound of crickets swelled in the gardens. Just before midnight, Baba asked us to help him into bed. Soraya and I placed his arms on our shoulders and wrapped ours around his back. When we lowered him, he had Soraya turn off the bedside lamp. He asked us to lean in and give us each a kiss. "I'll come back with your morphine pills and a glass of water, Kaka John," Soraya said. "Not tonight," he said. "There is no pain tonight." "Okay," she said. She pulled up his blanket. We closed the door. Baba never woke up. They filled the parking spots at the mosque in Hayward. On the balding grass field behind the building, cars and SUVs parked in crowded makeshift rows. People had to drive 3 or 4 blocks north of the mosque to find a spot. The men's section of the mosque was a large square room, covered with Afghan rugs and thin mattresses placed in parallel lines. Men filed into the room, leaving their shoes at the entrance, and sat cross-legged on the mattresses. A mullah chanted surahs from the Quran into a microphone. I sat by the door, the customary position for the family of the deceased. General Tahiri was seated next to me. Through the open door, I could see lines of cars pulling in, sunlight glinting in their windshields. They dropped off passengers, men dressed in dark suits, women clad in black dresses, their heads covered with traditional white hijabs. As words from the Quran echoed through the room, I thought of the old story of Baba wrestling a black bear in Balochistan. Baba had wrestled bears his whole life, losing his young wife, raising a son by himself, leaving his beloved homeland, his watan, poverty, indignity. In the end, a bear had come that he couldn't best, but even then, he had lost on his own terms. After each round of prayers, groups of mourners lined up and greeted me on their way out. Dutifully, I shook their hands, many of them I barely knew. I smiled politely and thanked them for their wishes, listened to whatever they had to say about Baba. Helped me build the house in Taimani. Bless him. No one else to turn to, and he lent me, found me a job, barely knew me, like a brother to me. Listening to them, I realized how much of who I was and what I was had been defined by Baba and the marks he had left on people's lives. My whole life, I had been Baba's son. Now, he was gone. Baba couldn't show me the way anymore. I'd have to find it on my own. The thought of it terrified me. Earlier, at the gravesite in the small Muslim section of the cemetery, I had watched them lower Baba into the hole. The mullah and another man got into an argument over which was the correct ayat of the Quran to recite at the gravesite. It might have turned ugly had General Tahiri not intervened. The mullah chose an ayat and recited it, casting the other fellow nasty glances. I watched him toss the first shovelful of dirt into the grave. Then I left, walked to the other side of the cemetery and sat in the shade of a red maple. Now, the last of the mourners had paid their respects and the mosque was empty, save for the mullah unplugging the microphone and wrapping his Quran in green cloth. The general and I stepped out into a late afternoon sun. We walked down the steps, past men smoking in clusters. I heard snippets of their conversations, a soccer game in Union City next weekend, a new Afghan restaurant in Santa Clara. Life moving on already, leaving Baba behind. "How are you, Bachim?" General Tahiri said. I gritted my teeth and bit back the tears that had threatened all day. "I'm going to find Suraya," I said. "Okay." I walked to the women's side of the mosque. Suraya was standing on the steps with her mother and a couple of ladies I recognized vaguely from the wedding. I motioned to Suraya. She said something to her mother and came to me. "Can we walk?" I said. "Sure." She took my hand. We walked in silence down a winding gravel path lined by a row of low hedges. We sat on a bench and watched an elderly couple kneeling beside a grave a few rows away and placing a bouquet of daisies by the headstone. "Suraya?" I said. "Yes." "I'm going to miss him," I said. She put her hand on my lap. Baba's chela glinted on her ring finger. Behind her, I could see Baba's mourners driving away on Mission Boulevard. Soon, we'd leave too, and for the first time ever, Baba would be all alone. Suraya pulled me to her, and the tears finally came. Because Suraya and I never had an engagement period, much of what I learned about the Tahiris I learned after I married into their family. For example, I learned that once a month, the general suffered from blinding migraines that lasted almost a week. When the headache struck, the general went to his room, undressed, turned off the light, locked the door, and didn't come out until the pain subsided. No one was allowed to go in, no one was allowed to knock. Eventually, he would emerge, dressed in his gray suit once more, smelling of sleep and bedsheets, his eyes puffy and bloodshot. I learned from Suraya that he and Khanum Tahiri had slept in separate rooms for as long as she could remember. I learned that he could be petty, such as when he'd take a bite of the qurma his wife placed before him, sigh, and push it away. "I'll make you something else," Khanum Tahiri would say, but he would ignore her, sulk, and eat bread and onion. This made Suraya angry and her mother cry. Suraya told me he took antidepressants. I learned that he had kept his family on welfare and had never held a job in the U.S., preferring to cash government-issued checks than degrading himself with work unsuitable for a man of his stature. He saw the flea market only as a hobby, a way to socialize with his fellow Afghans. The general believed that sooner or later Afghanistan would be freed, the monarchy restored, and his services would once again be called upon. So every day, he donned his gray suit, wound his pocket watch, and waited. I learned that Khanum Tahiri, whom I called Khala Jamila now, had once been famous in Kabul for her enchanting singing voice. Though she had never sung professionally, she had had the talent to. I learned she could sing folk songs, ghazals, even raga, which was usually a man's domain. But as much as the general appreciated listening to music, he owned, in fact, a considerable collection of classical ghazal tapes by Afghan and Hindi singers, he believed the performing of it best left to those with lesser reputations. That she never sing in public had been one of the general's conditions when they had married. Suraya told me that her mother had wanted to sing at our wedding, only one song, but the general gave her one of his looks, and the matter was buried. Khala Jamila played the lotto once a week and watched Johnny Carson every night. She spent her days in the garden, tending to her roses, geraniums, potato vines, and orchids. When I married Suraya, the flowers and Johnny Carson took a backseat. I was the new delight in Khala Jamila's life. Unlike the general's guarded and diplomatic manners, He didn't correct me when I continued to call him General Sahib. Khala Jamila made no secret of how much she adored me. For one thing, I listened to her impressive list of maladies, something the general had long turned a deaf ear to. Surayat told me that ever since her mother's stroke, every flutter in her chest was a heart attack, every aching joint the onset of rheumatoid arthritis, and every twitch of the eye another stroke. I remember the first time Khala Jamila mentioned a lump in her neck to me. "I'll skip school tomorrow and take you to the doctor," I said, to which the general smiled and said, "Then you might as well turn in your books for good, Bachim. Your Khala's medical charts are like the works of Rumi. They come in volumes." But it wasn't just that she had found an audience for her monologues of illness. I firmly believed that if I had picked up a rifle and gone on a murdering rampage, I would have still had the benefit of her unblinking love. Because I had rid her heart of its gravest malady. I had relieved her of the greatest fear of every Afghan mother, that no honorable khastagar would ask for her daughter's hand, that her daughter would age alone, husbandless, childless. Every woman needed a husband, even if he did silence the song in her. And from Suraya, I learned the details of what had happened in Virginia. We were at a wedding. Suraya's uncle, Sharif, the one who worked for the INS, was marrying his son to an Afghan girl from Newark. The wedding was at the same hall where, 6 months prior, Suraya and I had had our arusi. We were standing in a crowd of guests, watching the bride accept rings from the groom's family, when we overheard two middle-aged women talking, their backs to us. "What a lovely bride," one of them said. "Just look at her, so maqbool like the moon." "Yes," the other said, "and pure too, virtuous, no boyfriends." "I know," the other said. "I tell you, that boy did well not to marry his cousin." Suraya broke down on the way home. I pulled the Ford off to the curb and parked under a street light on Fremont Boulevard. "It's all right," I said, pushing back her hair. "Who cares?" "It's so fucking unfair," she barked. "Just forget it," I said. "Their sons go out to nightclubs looking for meat and get the girlfriends pregnant. They have kids out of wedlock and no one says a goddamn thing. Oh, they're just men having fun. And I make one mistake, and suddenly everyone's talking Nang and Nomus, and I have to have my face rubbed in it for the rest of my life." I wiped a tear from her jawline, just above her birthmark, with the pad of my thumb. "I didn't tell you," Suraya said, dabbing at her eyes. "But my father showed up with a gun that night. He told him that he had two bullets in the chamber, one for him and one for himself if I didn't come home. I was screaming and calling my father all kinds of names and saying he couldn't keep me locked up forever, that I wished he were dead." Fresh tears squeezed out between her lids. "I actually said that to him, that I wished he were dead. When he brought me home, my mother threw her arms around me and she was crying too. She was saying things, but I couldn't understand any of it because she was slurring her words so badly. So my father took me up to my bedroom and sat me in front of the dresser mirror. He handed me a pair of scissors and calmly asked me to cut off all my hair. He watched while I did it. I didn't step out of the house for weeks. And when I did, I heard whispers or imagined them everywhere I went. That was 4 years ago and 3,000 miles away, and I'm still hearing them." "Fuck 'em," I said. She made a sound that was half sob, half laugh. "When I told you about this on the phone the night of Khastagari, I was sure you'd change your mind," she said. "No chance of that, Suraya." She smiled and took my hand. "I'm so lucky to have found you. You're so different from every Afghan guy I've met." "Let's never talk about this again, okay?" I said. "Okay." I kissed her cheek and pulled away from the curb. As I drove, I wondered why I was different. Maybe it was because I had been raised by men. I hadn't grown up around women and had never been exposed firsthand to the double standard with which Afghan society sometimes treated them. Maybe it was because Baba had been such an unusual Afghan father, a liberal who had lived by his own rules, a maverick who had disregarded or embraced societal customs as he had seen fit. But I think a big part of the reason I didn't care about Soraya's past was that I had one of my own. I knew all about regret. Shortly after Baba's death, Soraya and I moved into a one-bedroom apartment in Fremont, just a few blocks away from the general and Khala Jamila's house. Soraya's parents bought us a brown leather couch and a set of Mikasa dishes as housewarming presents. The general gave me an additional present, a brand new IBM typewriter. In the box, he had slipped a note written in Farsi. "Amir John, I hope you discover many tales on these keys. General Iqbal Tahiri." I sold Baba's VW bus, and to this day, I have not gone back to the flea market. I would drive to his gravesite every Friday, and sometimes I'd find a fresh bouquet of freesias by the headstone and know Soraya had been there too. Soraya and I settled into the routines and minor wonders of married life. We shared toothbrushes and socks, passed each other the morning paper. She slept on the right side of the bed, I preferred the left. She liked fluffy pillows, I liked the hard ones. She ate her cereal dry, like a snack, and chased it with milk. I got my acceptance at San Jose State that summer and declared an English major. I took on a security job, swing shift at a furniture warehouse in Sunnyvale. The job was dreadfully boring, but its saving grace was a considerable one. When everyone left at 6 p.m., and shadows began to crawl between aisles of plastic-covered sofas piled to the ceiling, I took up my books and studied. It was in the pine-sol-scented office of that furniture warehouse that I began my first novel. Soraya joined me at San Jose State the following year and enrolled, to her father's chagrin, in the teaching track. "I don't know why you're wasting your talents like this," the general said one night over dinner. "Did you know, Amir John, that she earned nothing but A's in high school?" He turned to her. "An intelligent girl like you could become a lawyer, a political scientist. And inshallah, when Afghanistan is free, you could help write the new constitution. There would be a need for young, talented Afghans like you. They might even give you a ministry position, given your family name." I could see Soraya holding back, her face tightening. "I'm not a girl, Padar. I'm a married woman. Besides, they'd need teachers too," she said. "Anyone can teach," he said. "Is there any more rice, Madar?" Soraya said. After the general excused himself to meet some friends in Hayward, Khala Jamila tried to console Soraya. "He means well," she said. "He just wants you to be successful. So he can boast about his attorney daughter to his friends? Another medal for the general?" Soraya said. "Such nonsense you speak," Khala Jamila said. "Successful," Soraya hissed. "At least I'm not like him, sitting around while other people fight the Shorawi, waiting for when the dust settles so he can move in and reclaim his posh little government position. Teaching may not pay much, but it's what I want to do. It's what I love. And it's a whole lot better than collecting welfare, by the way." Khala Jamila bit her tongue. "If he ever hears you saying that, he will never speak to you again." "Don't worry," Soraya snapped, tossing her napkin on the plate. "I won't bruise his precious ego." In the summer of 1988, about 6 months before the Soviets withdrew from Afghanistan, I finished my first novel, a father-son story set in Kabul, written mostly with a typewriter the general had given me. I sent query letters to a dozen agencies, and was stunned one August day when I opened our mailbox and found a request from a New York agency for the completed manuscript. I mailed it the next day. Soraya kissed the carefully wrapped manuscript, and Khala Jamila insisted we pass it under the Quran. She told me that she was going to do Nazr for me, a vow to have a sheep slaughtered and the meat given to the poor if my book was accepted. "Please no Nazr, Khala John," I said, kissing her face. "Just do zakat. Give the money to someone in need, okay? No sheep killing. 6 weeks later, a man named Martin Greenwald called from New York and offered to represent me. I only told Soraya about it. But just because I have an agent doesn't mean I'll get published. If Martin sells a novel, then we'll celebrate, I said. A month later, Martin called and informed me I was going to be a published novelist. When I told Soraya, she screamed. We had a celebration dinner with Soraya's parents that night. Khala Jamila made kofta, meatballs and white rice, and chocolate firni. The general, a sheen of moisture in his eyes, said that he was proud of me. After General Tahiri and his wife left, Soraya and I celebrated with an expensive bottle of Merlot I had bought on the way home. The general didn't approve of women drinking alcohol, and Soraya didn't drink in his presence. I'm so proud of you, she said, raising her glass to mine. Kaka would have been proud too. I know, I said, thinking of Baba, wishing he could have seen me. Later that night, after Soraya fell asleep, wine always made her sleepy. I stood on the balcony and breathed in the cool summer air. I thought of Rahim Khan and the little note of support he had written me after he had read my first story. And I thought of Hassan. Someday, inshallah, you will be a great writer, he had once said, and people all over the world will read your stories. There was so much goodness in my life, so much happiness, and I wondered whether I deserved any of it. The novel was released in the summer of that following year, 1989, and the publisher sent me on a 5-city book tour. I became a minor celebrity in the Afghan community. That was the year that the Shorawi completed the withdrawal from Afghanistan. It should have been a time of glory for Afghans. Instead, the war raged on, this time between Afghans, the Mujahideen against the Soviet puppet government of Najibullah, and Afghan refugees kept flocking to Pakistan. That was the year that the Cold War ended, the year the Berlin Wall came down. It was the year of Tiananmen Square, and in the midst of it all, Afghanistan was forgotten. And General Tahiri, whose hopes had stirred awake after the Soviets pulled out, went back to winding his pocket watch. That was also the year that Soraya and I began trying to have a child. The idea of fatherhood unleashed a swirl of emotions in me. I found it frightening, invigorating, daunting, and exhilarating all at the same time. What sort of father would I make, I wondered. I wanted to be just like Baba, and I wanted to be nothing like him. But a year passed, and nothing happened. With each cycle of blood, Soraya grew more frustrated, more impatient, and more irritable. By then, Khala Jamila's initially subtle hints had become overt, as in, Khodiga, so, when am I going to sing Allahu for my little Nawasa? The general, ever the Pashtun, never made any queries. Doing so meant alluding to a sexual act between his daughter and a man, even if the man in question had been married to her for over 4 years. But his eyes perked up when Khala Jamila teased us about a baby. Sometimes it takes a while, I told Soraya one night. A year isn't a while, Amir, she said, in a terse voice so unlike her. Something's wrong, I know it. Then let's see a doctor, I said. Dr. Rosen, a round-bellied man with a plump face and small, even teeth, spoke with a faint Eastern European accent, something remotely Slavic. He had a passion for trains. His office was littered with books about the history of railroads, model locomotives, paintings of trains trundling on tracks through green hills and over bridges. A sign above his desk read, "Life is a train. Get on board." He laid out the plan for us. I would get checked first. "Men are easy," he said, fingers tapping on his mahogany desk. "A man's plumbing is like his mind. Simple, very few surprises. You ladies, on the other hand, well, God put a lot of thought into making you." I wondered if he fed that bit about the plumbing to all of his couples.
Lucky us, Surayal said.
Dr. Rosen laughed. It fell a few notches short of genuine. He gave me a lap slip and a plastic jar and handed Surayal a request for some routine blood tests. We shook hands.
Welcome aboard, he said as he showed us out.
I passed with flying colors. The next few months were a blur of tests on Surayal. Basal body temperatures, blood tests for every conceivable hormone, urine tests, something called a cervical mucus test, ultrasounds, more blood tests, and more urine tests. Surayal underwent a procedure called a hysteroscopy. Dr. Rosen inserted a telescope into Surayal's uterus and took a look around. He found nothing. The plumbing's clear, he announced, snapping off his latex gloves. I wished he would stop calling it that. We weren't bathrooms. When the tests were over, he explained that he couldn't explain why we couldn't have kids. And apparently, that wasn't so unusual. It was called unexplained infertility. Then came the treatment phase. We tried a drug called Clomifen, an HMG, a series of shots which Surayal gave to herself. When these failed, Dr. Rosen advised in vitro fertilization. We received a polite letter from our HMO, wishing us the best of luck, regretting they couldn't cover the cost. We used the advance I had received from my novel to pay for it. IVF proved lengthy, meticulous, frustrating, and ultimately unsuccessful. After months of sitting in waiting rooms reading magazines like Good Housekeeping and Reader's Digest, after endless paper gowns and cold, sterile exam rooms lit by fluorescent lights, the repeated humiliation of discussing every detail of our sex life with a total stranger, the injections and probes and specimen collections, we went back to Dr. Rosen and his trains. He sat across from us, tapped his desk with his fingers, and used the word adoption for the first time. Surayal cried all the way home. Surayal broke the news to her parents the weekend after our last visit with Dr. Rosen. We were sitting on picnic chairs in the Tahiri's backyard, grilling trout and sipping yogurt d'or. It was an early evening in March of 1991. Khala Jamila had watered the roses and her new honeysuckles, and their fragrance mixed with the smell of cooking fish. Twice already, she had reached across her chair to caress Surayal's hair and say, God knows best, Bachim. Maybe it wasn't meant to be. Surayal kept looking down at her hands. She was tired, I knew, tired of it all. The doctor said we could adopt, she murmured. General Tahiri's head snapped up at this. He closed the barbecue lid.
He did? He said.
He said it was an option, Surayal said. We had talked at home about adoption. Surayal was ambivalent at best. I know it's silly and maybe vain, she said to me on the way to her parents' house, but I can't help it. I've always dreamed that I would hold it in my arms and know that my blood had fed it for 9 months, that I would look in its eyes one day and be startled to see you or me, that the baby would grow up and have your smile or mine. Without that, is that wrong?
No, I had said.
Am I being selfish? She said.
No, Surayal.
Because if you really want to do it, she said.
No, I said.
If we're going to do it, we shouldn't have any doubts at all about it, and we should both be in agreement. It wouldn't be fair to the baby otherwise. She rested her head on the window and said nothing else the rest of the way. Now the general sat beside her.
Bachim, this adoption thing, I'm not so sure it's for us Afghans.
Surayal looked at me tiredly and sighed. For one thing, the general said, they grow up and want to know who the natural parents are. Nor can you blame them. Sometimes they leave the home in which you labored for years to provide for them so they can find the people who gave them life. Blood is a powerful thing, Bachim. Never forget that.
I don't want to talk about this anymore, Suraya said. I'll say one more thing, he said. I could tell he was getting revved up. We were about to get one of the general's little speeches. Take Emir John here. We all